Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Maureen, your Canva presentation looks brilliant. Thanks, Brett. That's because I used AI-powered Canva presentations. I just described what I wanted, and Canva presentations generated the perfect slides. You can even make a talking presentation for people to watch on their own time. Check this out. Recording. 101 Reasons Why Beaches is the Saddest Film Ever Made by your neighbour Maureen. Is it easy to use? If you can use a computer, you can nail your next work presentation with Canva Presentations at canva.com, designed for work. Oh, thanks, my neighbour Maureen. Yeah, thank you.
Look out, it's only films to be buried with.
Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. My name is Brett Goldstein. I'm a comedian, an actor, a writer, a director, a smoke signal, and I love films. As Gonzo the Great once said, it was the afternoon of Christmas Eve, and Scrooge was conscious of a thousand odours, each one connected with a thousand thoughts and hopes and joys and cares long, long forgotten. He couldn't wait to watch Muppet Christmas Carol again. Oh, that's lovely. Thank you, Gonzo. Good shout. Every week, I invite a special guest over. I tell them they've died. Then I get them to discuss their life through the films that meant the most to them. Previous guests include Kevin Smith, Sharon Stone, Ricky Gervais, Jamila Jamil, James McNicholas, and even Bed Bambles. But this week, it's part two with the brilliant filmmaker and dream guest, Mr. Edgar Wright. This week, as a Christmas present to you all, I've included all of the Patreon section, except for Edgar's secret, which I've kept safe only for the Patreons. If you want to find special bonus features, extra questions, videos and secrets for all the episodes, head over to patreon.com/Brett Goldstein. And if you've not seen it yet, lovely time to watch it would be Christmas. You can watch the whole of season one of Ted Lasso on the Apple TV Plus app. Watch it, you'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll feel good. So, last week, we left part one on a huge cliffhanger. So here we are to pick up exactly where we left off. That is it for now. I very much hope you enjoy episode 127, part two of Edgar Wright's Films to be Buried With.
What's the film that you used to love, really loved it, and you've watched it recently, and you don't love it anymore? It might not be because the film's bad, you just feel differently, you've changed. Not the film.
Well, this would be heresy to some people, but these people need to hear it.
Okay.
The Goonies is maybe not a great movie. And I say that. Goonies, when you're 12 years old, is the best.
Yeah.
And when I saw that at the cinema in 1986, so maybe it's 1985, I was probably 11 or 12, and I thought the Goonies was the best.
Yeah.
But then, and it's that weird thing is obviously you come back to something like that with such nostalgia and, like, you get the DVD, and I remember once I tried to watch The Goonies with the cast commentary.
Oh, wow.
And having all of the Goonies talk. In the movie, the Goonies are all talking at the same time, so anybody who's not 12 is going to get an immediate headache. Now imagine watching The Goonies with all of the cast talking and all of the cast talking on the cast commentary. I defy anybody to get through that without having to reach for the Nurofen at the end. So I'll say this, is like The Goonies is the perfect movie for 12, but sometimes when I see people who are any person over 35 that has The Goonies in their top 10 of all time needs to see a psychiatrist.
Right, you are specifically talking about Matt Ford, who has done this podcast.
Matt Ford, and, please.
Loves Goonies more than anything else.
Please, Matt Ford.
More than Nottingham
Forest. For your kids, yes, but not for yourself. Pick an adult movie.
Wow. That's the pull quote. Edgar, what is the film that means the most to you? Not necessarily the film special, but because of the experience you had around seeing the film that will always make it special to you.
Well, I've already talked about Rumble in the Bronx.
Yeah.
There's two quick answers to this. One of them, well, weirdly enough, to follow immediately on from Goonies, let's talk about a film that I watched when I was 10 that does hold up. Gremlins. Now, that film holds up. And that film, I watched it the other day. That yeah. film holds up because it's so, like, especially now. Especially if you watch it now that movie got made. That movie would never get made in the same way now.
Yeah.
It's so savage and it's so gleefully shooting down kids' movies and Christmas movies
yeah.
and even like Amblin movies themselves, even though it is an Amblin movie. But when I saw Gremlins when I was 10 years old yeah. and it was a 15. Nice. In 1984, the Wells Regal, which is where I lived from 11 to 18 in right. Somerset. So Gremlins, like, because it's coming hot on the heels of E.T.,
mm-hmm.
like, there's toys for Gremlins, there's stickers for Gremlins, there's, like, a picture book for Gremlins, there's the novelization of Gremlins. And then, Gremlins in the U.S. was a PG. And there were so many complaints about Gremlins and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom that they created the PG-13. With Spielberg's blessing, I think Spielberg was involved in this decision, is like, we have to have a new rating because there were so many complaints about Gremlins and Temple of Doom. They created the PG-13.
And Poltergeist?
Poltergeist was before that, but that was a yeah. PG-13, but then got re-rated.
Right.
Anyway, so Poltergeist, yeah, it was a PG, which is crazy.
PG, yeah.
It's 15 in the UK. In the UK, they until 1989 with Batman, when they finally created the 12,
yeah.
there was no interim thing. So Gremlins was a 15. Now, this was after all of these, like, the... What are those things that...
actually wearing pyjamas.
Panini stickers. Is it
yeah,
Panini?
Yeah, Panini, yeah.
Yeah, they had the kind of... They had the Euro 86 ones. So it was like Panini Gremlin stickers. I had, like, the stickers. I had read the novelization. I had the picture book. I didn't have any of the toys. But then it's like the film is a 15. And this just seems like me and my brother were, like, personally affronted by this. It was like, how dare they?
Yeah.
So we used to go to our, like, Saturday morning film club at the Wells Regal. And we went up to the manager with the novelization of Gremlins in hand. And we went up to the manager and said, please, can we come and see Gremlins today? Because we know it's the 15, but we've read the novelization and we know what happens, so we won't be scared. And then amazingly, this manager says, come back at 2 o'clock. So he let, and it was then the tickets were like £1. So we came back like for the matinee.
Yeah.
The manager like turned a blind eye. We, you know, and then the one bit of the charade we had to go through was you had to go up to the ticket lady and say like, how old are you? And we go, 15. That was enough. Back then, later, when I was maybe 13, trying to get into 15s, I had this crazy idea trying to get into the Lost Boys. That did you ever have that thing where you put hair gel into your hair to make you look older?
Yeah, and my mum had told me for some reason that 15-year-olds had one hand in their pocket. So I'd always have one hand in my pocket, like Alanis Morissette.
So I saw Gremlins,
yeah.
10 years old, and like, oh my God, the most exciting screening of all time. Not only because the film was great,
yeah,
but also I felt like I was going to get thrown out at any minute. So it made it so ridiculously exciting. Really. The one other one I want to mention, yeah. really quickly. A couple of years ago, I was at the TCM Festival in Hollywood,
mm-hmm.
where they show a lot of like old movies, and it was the 50th anniversary screening of In the Heat of the Night with Sidney Poitier.
Ooh.
And 50th anniversary screening, and Norman Jewison was there, the director, and Lee Grant, and they were on stage for a Q&A, and Sidney Poitier was also present, but not on stage, and I think maybe he has dementia or something, or he was able to attend but did not want to do a Q&A.
Okay.
But he was there, and of course at the start they say, ladies and gentlemen, Sidney Poitier is in the house. So yeah. Sidney Poitier is not on stage for a Sidney Poitier classic,
yeah.
which won Best Picture in its day. But so he gets up and gets a standing O. But then, during the movie, I'm like on the next block to him, and it's at the Chinese theatre. And at one point I want to go to the toilet in the middle of it, the bathroom, as they say in the day. And for the American listeners. So I got up and I stopped dead because then I was looking at Sidney Poitier looking at himself on the screen. And so Sidney Poitier was massive on the screen. And then it was one of those things where, you know, in this day and age where like everybody takes a photo of everything.
Yeah.
And it's just one of the things where you're standing thinking, I guess I'm just going to have to remember this mental picture forever of Sidney Poitier sitting forward in his seat with a silver screen, like illuminating his face, looking at a massive close-up of himself from 50 years ago. And I just, I had just stopped in the aisle for about 30 seconds because I just thought, I just have to soak this in, this magical moment. So that was very memorable to me.
That's pretty great. What, Edgar Wright, is the film you most relate to?
This is a tricky one because I think when you're younger, you have films that you want to believe that you're that person, but you're not.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure when I was like 12, I thought maybe I was Ferris Bueller, but of course I'm not Ferris Bueller. I've never done anything that wild. I was maybe, if not a mischief maker at school, definitely a bit of an entrepreneur in terms of I used to make like movies when as soon as I was like 14, I was starting making movies and stuff. So it's definitely a bit of an entrepreneur, but I wasn't like a troublemaker. Like, and then also as you get older, you realize that Ferris Bueller is like a sociopath as well. So there's people like that. There's people in that regard, like Max Fisher in Rushmore or Ferris Bueller. You sort of like think you want to be that person, and then as you get older, you're thinking A, you're not that person, and B, maybe you shouldn't be that person. So I think it's probably like people like, I like Gregory and Gregory's Girl or something is like a daydreamer, hopeless romantic, like. Can't see the wood for the trees. I guess that like, you gravitate towards those people, but honestly, to be perfectly honest,
please,
I think that some of the movies I've done, specifically Shaun of the Dead and The World's End, you're writing films where you are putting yourself on screen because you've never seen specifically that person.
Right.
So I think with Shaun of the Dead, there are like lines that both Shaun says and Liz, played by Kate Ashfield.
Mm.
Is sort of vocalizing things that I've literally said.
Right.
And then in World's End, I think that, like, the different characters are all amalgams of, like, me and Simon. Like, Gary King is an amalgam of me and Simon. Like, Nick's character, Andy Knightley, is an amalgam of me and Simon. So it's that thing where, you know, there's a certain... I think with Shaun of the Dead, there was an element of making that film, not to talk about myself.
Yeah, but please.
There was an element of, like, making that film where we hadn't seen people like that... that were quite like ourselves on screen in a British movie.
Yeah.
Maybe like a Mike Lee movie gets closest, where there's like, I wouldn't say like I'm any of the characters in Life is Sweet, but when you see something like that at the cinema, you're thinking, oh, this is a bit more close to home, you know? In fact, my dad is a bit like Jim Broadbent in Life is Sweet in terms of my dad and Jim Broadbent share the same thing of like claiming that they're DIY experts and they're never finishing anything. But I feel like... If you'd asked me when I was like 15 years old, I said, oh yeah, I'm like Ferris Bueller, but of course I'm not.
You were like Shaun of the Dead.
Yes. Or specifically, Kate Ashfield has dialogue in the opening of Shaun of the Dead that is literally me speaking because Simon and Nick used to be obsessed by this pub that's now called the Boogaloo, but used to be called the Shepherds.
Yeah. Right.
And newsflash, I didn't think the Shepherds was all that. Like, they thought it was like, they talked about it.
Bombs everywhere.
They talked about it like they talk about the Winchester in Shaun of the Dead.
Right.
And the thing is, in that period, around the time of Spaced, to hang out with Simon and Nick, you had to go to them. They would never dream of coming to me. They would never come to Islington. They would very rarely come into town. It would be this period of, it felt like a couple of years, maybe more, where I started to see Simon and Nick. You would have to go to Highgate and go to the Shepherds. And then they would, you know, and that's where you would hang out. So when Kate Ashfield is talking at the start of the movie, saying, like, do we always have to come to the Winchester? You know, is me talking to them. So I think that's probably it, is that, like, you end... And I think, in a way, you make other movies in a similar way that I'm not Ferris Bueller. You make movies, like so you can live vicariously through other characters.
Yes.
So like I'm not a getaway driver, but you know, making Baby Driver is as close to being a getaway driver as I could get. I can never time travel to the 60s in London, but I can make Last Night in Soho, and that is as close as I'm gonna get.
Nice.
You know, and so you end up like, I feel a big part of that of making movies is me actually getting to sort of like a bit of wish fulfillment in terms of like what the characters are actually doing.
I love it.
Hot Fuzz is like me causing complete, that is shot in my hometown.
Yeah.
So it is me, it's like literally like a love-hate letter to my like hometown in terms of it's both, I love that place, and also there's part of me that wants to just kind of cause absolute mayhem, which is exactly what we did while shooting the movie.
That's great. Edgar Wright, what's the sexiest film ever made? And for the record, one of my answers would be American Werewolf in London.
Well, I felt, again, American Werewolf in London was too on brand for me.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I said I could answer it for every movie. American Werewolf in London is definitely a thing. And so I got like a... Here's one thing that's funny. It's like, and I'm going to really embarrass my brother now.
Okay.
My brother Oscar, who's 2 years older. But you know sometimes when... do you have siblings?
Yeah, I've got a sister, 2 years older. Love
you
her.
Have a thing like with a sibling or a friend where they have done something you're thinking, I can't believe that I didn't think of that first.
Right.
My brother, who's 2 years older, we didn't really get a VHS in the house until we were like 15. I think actually I ended up paying for the VHS from radio rentals. My brother had made a video taped of all the sexy bits from films onto one compilation thing, and snooping around in his bedroom like the little cunt I am, like I found his
supercut.
I found his supercut. This is before supercuts existed. Wow. Now, when I found it, I felt like it was this thing. It was almost like it was so... We obviously have the same sort of taste, because it was like finding something. It's a bit like Lost Highway something. And wait, did I make this or dream it? No, he did it. How did I not do this first? And he had made this tape. And this is, I mean, I think I remember it more fondly than he does. I'm not sure that my brother's ever thought about this tape for like decades, but I do. He had made this tape, and it was like bits of movies.
Mm.
And they're all the bits like when you're young and kind of like adolescent and horny all the time. They're like not usually like sex movies, but like the sexy bits in movies. Like, yeah. American Werewolf in London is the perfect example. You have Jenny Agutter as the sexy nurse. Mm-hmm. You've also got the two like sort of like bits of like fictitious porn films, See You Next Wednesday,
yeah,
with Lindsay Drew, and I think there's somebody else as well. But like, you just think about when you watch that now, thinking like John Landis was obviously having the whale of a time yeah, shooting these fake pornos. Anyway, so it had American Werewolf in London on it. It also had clips of Bernadette Peters from The Jerk. also, I was very impressed by this because I had maybe thought this when I was watching it, but never thought to actually just clip these bits out. There's a Hammer movie called The Curse of the Werewolf,
right,
where the opening 15 minutes features this actress called, I think her name's Yvonne Romaine. And like, she's very, like all Hammer actresses, very voluptuous. And like all Hammer movies, there's a lot of cleavage in those clips. So this is a werewolf movie with Oliver Reed. And my brother had clipped out, you know, the kind of the key 5 minutes from that movie. On top of that, clips of No Sex, Please, We're British with Ronnie Corbett.
Wow.
Where there's like a scene with Valerie Leon and Margaret Nolan playing like escorts. Margaret Nolan, who is in Last Night in Soho, and sadly, her final screen role. She's only does a tiny cameo in it. I didn't mention to her about the tape. what else was on there? It was mostly those anyway. So I was so... It was, I think, as I found this VHS and I was like, I can't believe that he has done this. It was like I'd done it and had amnesia and found it.
That's so funny.
But that's not my answer.
Right.
My answer is like a five-minute bit and it's not even the star of the movie, but in the Bob Fosse musical Sweet Charity.
Yes.
With Shirley MacLaine.
Mm-hmm.
There was an amazing dance number called The Rich Man's Frog. And the lead dancer in it, I remember like, watching this particular... If you've ever seen that movie, you'll know exactly which scene I'm talking about. It's an incredible dance number in this nightclub. I think it's called Vesuvius, the nightclub. And it's The Rich Man's Frog. And it's just like 5 solid minutes of dance. It's amazing. And the lead dancer, who I looked on IMDb, her name is Suzanne Charney. I just remember watching it thinking, I think that's the sexiest woman I've ever seen on screen. And so it's just this thing of just like, you know, like when somebody's just like the confidence of like, you know, like an amazing like Broadway dancer, like yeah, just like, oh my good God. So I kind of get weirdly fixated with like bits in other films, and that would be my answer.
That will go in your supercut.
So, yes.
What did your brother say when you found... Did you have a chat with your brother about finding the supercut?
I think I told him years later.
Oh,
I
you never discussed it at the time?
Not at the time, no. I just stole it from his room sometimes and then replaced it exactly where I left it. Then...
At the same
no,
point.
Wait. You know what? Thinking about it, we didn't discuss it until way later. I think he must have realised that I'd found it because mysteriously it vanished forever. And I think he realised that I'd found it, and then he put it in a new hiding place of which I could never find it. So at some point, after maybe me stealing it six or seven times, it then mysteriously vanished forever. But Oscar, I apologise for telling that story, but I'm just impressed that you did it.
Listen, Oscar sounds like a real go-getter.
He was the inventor of the supercut.
Yeah, he's way ahead of his time. Now, there is a subcategory to this question. Troubling boners, worrying wide-ons. What film did you find arousing, but you thought perhaps you shouldn't?
This is a tricky one. I mean, I feel like most of the answers to this have probably been done, because, like, I'm sure, like, every animated thing ever, like, people have talked about and stuff.
Yeah.
Can I mention if we were going real slow bar, can I mention a bit from a TV show? No. We're in the wrong heaven.
You've crossed the strange.
Okay, I shouldn't then.
You could mention it.
There is an episode of Mork and Mindy.
Yeah, love Mindy.
Where, like, it's an episode with Raquel Welch, and Mork is, like, tortured in inverted commas he's strapped to this kind of slab, mm-hmm. and disembodied female hands come. This isn't even, to be honest, this isn't even a strange one. It's just, like, a weird something that I've always remembered. And I think if I developed later in life any kink about having disembodied alien hands fondling me, it would be because of Mork and Mindy.
I mean, to be fair, that's a good answer. But have you got a film one?
I feel all of the things that I could think of, the filmmaker is obviously intending them to be sexy.
Yeah, yeah.
There's like sort of, I don't think there's anything, I'm not sure that anybody puts anything in a film that they're not intending to be sexy in some way.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, all of the things I think of are all things that people would go, well, yeah, of course, like, dead Barbara Steele in Black Sunday is sexier than living Barbara Steele. I mean, that's obvious. I guess it's like like people who are sexier with their zombie makeup on than off.
Yeah.
That would be the troubling one. Because then you're getting into necrophilia territory.
Yeah, that's a very good shout. Okay, I believe you've answered it. Edgar Wright, what's the greatest film ever made?
Objectively,
greatest film ever made. Correct.
I've actually said this on Twitter before, and I said, subject, you know, because there's a big thing, is like, if you ever, and I've come under fire for this a lot, I've put lists on the internet of my favourite films.
Yeah.
And people don't seem to understand the use of the word favourite.
Yeah.
Whenever you put a list up of favourite films, you'll immediately get, and I put up a list of 1,000 favourite films.
Yeah. And you've still got
people saying, no Predator. I'm saying, I'm sorry, it's not one of my favourite films. You know, like, people never understand that favourite is subjective.
Yes.
So with all that said, objectively, the best film of all time is A Miracle Wealth in London.
I'm so glad that's your answer.
If I had to go for... So that's a, like, sort
you
of,
know
like,
that everyone always says Godfather, it drives me mad. American Wealth in London is I
well,
would pick,
listen,
pick.
I mean, also, it's the film that, like, great at 10, great at 46. Like, scary, funny, male and female nudity.
Moving.
Like, sort of, like, moving, heartwarming, like, great soundtrack, great use of location.
Devastating at the end.
Small part for Rick Mayall.
Yeah.
Is he in The Godfather? No, he isn't.
No.
I mean, I think if I was going for, like, if I was, you know, like... I mean, that's the thing, is that the BFI do those lists, which I've been lucky to contribute to twice, of, like, the top 10.
Mm-hmm.
And I do feel that when people get asked that question of, like, the best films of all time, they always go for that kind of, like, I said, the coffee table movie, And there was a couple of movies that I watched over lockdown that were in the BFI Top 100, and I was like, There was one, he's long, long dead, so I'm not sure I can catch too much fire, but Jean Renoir's unfinished Day in the Country, 40 minutes long, an unfinished movie, which is utterly charming and beautiful, but still like an unfinished movie.
Mm.
And you think, wait, that's better than American Wealth in London?
No.
Or Rosemary's Baby? It's maybe better than Predator, so sorry, Predator fans. It's definitely better than The Goonies as a 46-year-old. Is it better than The Goonies when you're 12 years old? No. My classy answer to that is 2001 A Space Odyssey. Is now become the film that I have probably seen at the cinema the most.
That film comes under a lot of trouble on this podcast. I think it's great.
I think it's a work of art. I think it's like, It's like sort of where, I mean, and the further you get away from it, the more astounding it is, because it would never be made now. And if it was, it would never be made by a studio on a big budget.
No.
It's just absolutely confounding that that was like in the top 10 of its year, because the further you get away from it, the more and more arty it feels. And it's almost like when that, whenever that movie's on, I go and see it on the big screen, because it feels like going to like the opera or like going to see classical music being played.
Yeah.
And it's like, that really is that thing of like, okay, this is art, and we just have to sit here and be in awe of this spectacle.
What's the film you can or have watched the most over and over again?
There's a number of them. I'm going to say, because I watch it quite regularly, I'm going to say Brian De Palma's Carrie.
Oh.
Where I've watched many, many, many times. And I think part of the... Not only do I love it, but it's also a movie where... There's a point in that movie where just before everything goes terribly wrong, when the bucket of blood falls on Carrie... falls first on Tommy's head.
Yeah.
And then splatters Carrie of blood. I always feel the same thing when I watch that movie, as I'm thinking, maybe this time it will turn out all right.
Yeah.
Which I always feel, if you've seen a movie many times, it's quite a profound feeling to watch it, because it's not a choose-your-own-adventure book.
Yeah.
You can't sort of say, flick to the ending where everything's okay. But that's the thing, is I watch that movie and I always have that little hope that there might be a happy ending this time.
That's interesting. Yeah, because you know what? I watched a Brian De Palma film the other day.
The documentary.
Oh, no, I love that. But I watched Sisters, which I've never seen of his.
Oh, yeah, I love Sisters.
And I love Brian De Palma. And then sometimes, depending on my mood, sometimes I watch some of his films and I go, it's a shame. Like, sometimes they feel, some of them are like sort of fun exercises and sort of tricks and like rides, but that they lack a kind of emotional core. And Carrie is incredibly emotional.
No, it's also a very rare, and not a controversial statement for me, but people always say, what's the best Stephen King film? And everybody says The Shining, but it's not, it's Carrie.
Yeah.
Carrie is the best Stephen King film, because you really... I feel like the great thing about Carrie is that you... It's an unusual horror film in that, A, you don't want anything bad to happen to the lead, but also, B, you really want to see her take revenge. So you're egging on... You're egging on the revenge that will also end her life. Because it's like, I don't want anything bad to happen to her, but I also, like her, I want everybody to die. Except for Betty Buckley, the PE teacher, who gets killed in friendly fire.
Oh, yeah.
She thinks that everybody, she's got her mum's words in her head. They're all going to laugh at you. That's one of the great, that's the thing in that movie that really, like, makes it, is that she's so angry she kills everybody. Yeah. Even the people that don't deserve it.
That's interesting. So, bearing in mind everything we've said, what's the worst film you've ever seen?
Well, again, I have the answer, but I also have a complicated...
Oh, God, it's going to make us feel bad.
It made me feel bad. So, in the wake of, like, The Room, Tommy Wiseau's film...
Yes.
Now, I'm not going to mention that film, because I think there was a weird thing that happened there, is it felt like everybody was looking for the new Room. And the thing with The Room that I find... a bit difficult to get my head round is that it's obviously very entertainingly bad. But then when Tommy Wiseau himself leans into the joke and says, oh, I meant it to be funny.
Yeah.
You know that A, he's lying.
Yeah.
And B, that he's trying to make the best of a disaster.
Yeah, yeah.
But it makes me feel uncomfortable because I think,
I
like,
agree.
It makes me feel uncomfortable. And I can't, even though I actually went to one of those screenings at the Sunset Five when that cult was really taking off.
Yeah.
I remember going to see that with, like, Paul Rudd and Jonah Hill and Michael Cera and Kristen Bell.
Right.
Like, and went to see The Room. And it was fun, but then it made me feel a bit uneasy. And then after my conversation about Ricky O in Toronto that made me, like, forever feel bad for laughing at films.
Yeah.
Then there was this place in Los Angeles called the Cine Family, which doesn't exist anymore.
Mm.
And, I feel there was a, like, after The Room, everybody was looking to claim dibs on the new Room and being the cinema that would show the new Room. Like, contenders include that film Birdemic.
Yeah, Birdemic.
And then there's this other director called Neil Breen, I think his name is.
Yes, I've seen trailers of Neil Breen stuff.
Well, like, against my better judgment, given my feelings after the Ricky O incident, I went to see one of his films, Fateful Findings,
yes,
at the Cine Family. And because it had been so talked up by the people introducing it, and there's that something, that kind of slightly thing that makes me feel uneasy, that slightly bro-y thing with film programmers going, oh my God, you guys, wait till you see this. Oh my God, this is the most insane. I mean, if you thought the room was insane, wait till you see. Anyway, so it was that kind of intro leading up to this movie. And then there's that annoying thing, I think, is a particularly hipster thing, where people are laughing because they think they ought to.
Right.
Or there are people sort of having a competition in the crowd of who can laugh the hardest at anything.
Yeah.
Now, the film is terrible. There's no... Objectively, it's a terrible movie. So there was... That was the one thing that made me feel uncomfortable, was that the way that it was introduced is like sort of like... inviting scorn. I mean, I knew I should have gone there. I shouldn't have gone there in the first place when they're saying it could be the new room, Fatal Findings. And I remember I went with my girlfriend at the time. And then the other thing that complicated it, we were sitting on the back row. I thought I decided to sit on the back row because I felt like if I didn't like it, I wanted to get the fuck out of there.
Yeah.
But I couldn't immediately get out of there because Neil Breen himself had turned up and was sitting on the end of our row. And then during the movie, I was looking between the movie and everybody, like, laughing. Also, that thing is like when something's, like, something's genuinely funny or just inept, and it just felt like people were like, yes, it's bad, but people were, like, trying way too hard to sort of, like, be the crowd that found the new room, you know?
Right, right.
Anyway, I could not stop looking at Neil Breen's face. Yeah. And Neil Breen was sitting on the end of my row, and... I could see the conflict in his face, because on one hand, the film is getting an uproarious reaction, and also, it's a sellout. It's absolutely packed. On the flip side, they're all laughing at it.
Oh, God.
And, like, I think then he did a Q&A afterwards, and I just couldn't stomach it, and I said, let's go, and I got out of there. So I just couldn't, so it was terribly bad.
What was, like, being asked at the Q&A, like...
I honestly,
you didn't see any of it. Right, right.
I just couldn't. I think I watched a little. I know. He was there for the intro. He'd made a surprise appearance. He wasn't billed to be there.
Right.
He'd just shown up. But in his intro to the movie, you could tell that he was not necessarily at peace with the idea of this being a camp classic. So I was already feeling uneasy. And then watching his... contorted face during the movie, I did not stay for the Q&A. I had to get out of there.
Oh man, that breaks my heart. I feel that whole room thing and all of that is, we're all 1 degree away.
No, I know.
And
we
we could all make a room, and also you don't know. You think you know when you're making something, or your instincts are this, you think you've got good instincts and good taste. You don't know. Oh God, breaks my heart. The reality is, it's the same amount of work to make a good film and a bad film.
No, I mean, I think, like, the worst films, and I don't want to, like, mention any because, like, I probably had to be worked on them, but, like, I think the worst films, like I said, are boring ones or completely cynical ones. Like, sometimes there are, like, part five or something. Or, like, something like, you know, like, some franchises where every, like, 2 years they say, you know, like... they've hired somebody new to do something to, like, I know, the Transformers franchise. And I'm like, guys, please. I mean, again, I say that, like, I shouldn't be going to see a Transformers movie in my 40s. Like, if I was 10 years old, maybe I would think the Transformers movies are amazing. And they would be like the Goonies were for me at the time. But there's that thing where I feel like that thing is that I have a sort of complicated relationship to those things where... There's, like, sometimes there's movies that I think... It was a movie I saw at the cinema, and I felt like I should have had a son. I think, like, I shouldn't be sitting... I think it was something like the Lego Batman movie, which is a good movie.
Good movie.
It's a good movie. But I still felt at the end of it, I was in my, like, 40s, and I sat there and thinking, like, why am I here on my own watching this? I should have kids or something.
Yeah.
I just felt like... It's that thing sometimes, it's like going to see, like, kids' films as an adult... without any real reason to be there. Or watching them as an owl is like a weird thing sometimes.
Has something shifted?
Yeah, but like you feel like this would be a great movie. Like, if I was sat there on my own at age 46 watching The Goonies at the cinema, you feel like I'd need like an ankle bracelet or something. It's like just like, no. I mean, yes, if you were taking your 10-year-old nephew and saying, oh, my God, you're going to love this film, but if you're watching it on your own, please, no. Matt Ford, stop. Matt Ford, don't do it.
Listen, Matt Ford, I'm so sorry that this is what happened.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Edgar Wright, you are funny. You have made lots of comedies. A little side note, I think we talked about this off podcast, but I think it's interesting. So I'd like to say it again and have you say it again, if you don't mind, but in a really natural way, is that we're talking about space.
Yeah.
Which I love with all my heart. I've seen space a billion times. When I had a weird job in Spain, we used to work nights, and we had the DVD of Spaced. And when we'd come home at 6 in the morning, we'd get stoned and we'd watch Spaced over and over and over and over and over.
What was the weird job?
I ran a strip club for my dad.
Wow! I like this. This is the next sitcom.
Yeah, But every night, me and Beans, the DJ, we'd come home at 6 in the morning and watch it. Spaced was the only DVD we had.
That's great.
And we watched... I mean, a million times we've seen it. Anyway, what we were talking about and what I hadn't really thought about is Space is incredibly unusual as a sitcom, particularly a British sitcom, in that it was about sweet people who were nice, and it had a real sort of... It was crazy and it was wild and it was inventive and it was filmed in a way that hadn't been done before. But aside from all of that stuff, it was remarkably uncynical. I was suddenly like, what other British sitcom did that? That seems so... That's kind of revolutionary and hasn't really been done since.
No, I mean, we were talking earlier about... I said that Ted Lasso is, like, really genuine and sincere, and it's something that, like, really... for a show that's set in Britain, at least, it's like Anglo-American show, but, like, it's unusual. I mean, I think when we made Space, I'm not sure how much of that was a concerted effort, but it definitely stands out because most of the... big shows at the time, like classic shows, The Office, Alan Partridge, you know, Black Books, like sort of other, like, you know, and going back to the things that influenced us, even like the young ones, most of the characters are like grotesques and like kind of like assholes.
Yeah.
So I think it was maybe because Simon and Jess were essentially playing extensions of themselves that then they were so warm towards all of their creations. Like, you get the occasional bad guy character like Dwayne Benzie.
Yeah.
But most of the time, like, everybody in it is nice. And even people who, like, even people like Reese Christmas character, like, you know, like, he gets kind of folded in and becomes one of the nice guys by the end. So I think that's just, like, Simon and Jess are inherently, like, very warm writers. And, yeah, I don't remember that ever being a discussion, but it is something that really marks it out. And, you know, you just really want to spend time with those characters.
Yeah, it's so unusual. Yeah, and again, hasn't, for a show that I believe is still a massive cult success, hasn't really been emulated? Like, no, has it? You know, with the way The Office sparked a lot of shows like The Office. I don't think there are a lot of shows like Spaced, are there? Or am I stupid?
I guess sometimes you see things where there's elements of the style creep into other things, but... You know, it's difficult to kind of claim any ownership of that when you see things like, I don't know, like 30 Rock or Arrested Development or even some of that Fresh Meat that kind of have elements of Space. But then we ourselves were like, I mean, I would see like bits of space that we were riffing on doing like a live action version of The Simpsons, or like I used to really like Reggie Perrin.
Which
had like cutaways. Its little cutaways and like, and then you go back into cinema and it's like, oh, that stuff itself is like goes back to like Billy Liar or like, so yeah. It's not like any of the things when people sort of do a ripoff of Spaced, you know, like we ourselves were influenced by the thing, so you can't really kind of say, hey, you know, you ripped us off, because like never quite the same thing. And that, you know, and I mentioned two of those shows, 30 Rock and Arrested Development, are my absolute faves. I love those shows.
They're very good.
Oh my God. 30 Rock is just like the sort of getting close to like Marx Brothers speed, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like how many jokes can you cram into like 22 minutes?
It's quite incredible. I watched 30 Rock too quickly and I felt disrespectful because I thought there's so much amazing stuff in this and I'm just watching them one after the other and I should be stopping after every 22 minutes and, you know, paying respects. Singling out jokes. Anyway, the reason I bring all of this up is, what's the film that made you laugh the most?
Well, there's several films that I've seen many, many times, and I think most of them are going to be ones that people have mentioned before, like Spinal Tap or Airplane. So I'm going to go for a slightly deeper cut in the same direction. I'm going to say 1984's Top Secret.
Top Secret!
Which is a film where that film sort of was a flop at the time, partly because, like, and it's they analyse themselves, Zucker, Abraham Zucker. The reason that they thought it didn't, like, completely land is because it's all jokes and no story.
Yeah.
However, the jokes are so... I guess a film I sort of obsessed with because I was so in awe of the execution of some of the jokes and the level of, like, production. And it's, like, so... There's so many, like, big jokes, little jokes, very silly jokes... So I feel like maybe because that film is, like, less loved than Airplane and Naked Gun, I feel more ownership over Top Secret. And I've watched it many, many, many times.
That's a lovely...
And I actually... I did a Q&A. I used to program at the New Beverly in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. the cinema that Tarantino now owns.
Wow.
And I did a double bill of... I think it was, like, Top Secret and Bananas. And Top Secret, we were trying to get, like... Jim Abrahams and David Zucker to come down and do the Q&A. And Jim Abrahams said yes, because he said him and his son really loved Shaun of the Dead. And David Zucker said, no, I'm not going to come for Top Secret. If you show Airplane or Naked Gun, I'll come. But Top Secret was a flop, and I've never seen it since.
Oh, wow.
So I was like, wow. And I sort of, like, got in touch with him, and I said, well, listen, I said, if you come, you're going to have the most partisan crowd for Top Secret ever. And I swear everybody there will know every line, and you might surprise yourself. So he changed his tune and he came. Yes. Now, Jim Abrahams, I met him before the movie started. That was great. Right. And then David Zucker said, I can't be there at the start. I'll be there for the Q&A. But then David Zucker sort of turned up, and then I was sitting in the row in front of them, and I could hear Jim Abrahams and David Zucker howling all the way through it. And then the nice thing was, the first time I met David Zucker... But I went up to him as the credits were rolling, and he looked at me and he goes, that's a funny movie. I said, I know, I told you it was. But that movie is like...
That's such a nice
That
spirit.
Movie, it's like sort of patchy, and you could see why it wasn't a hit at the time.
Yeah.
But, oh my God, the highs are so funny. I love it so much. My favourite joke in it is a really dumb joke when Val Kilmer's been sent to prison... Mm-hmm. And it cuts to like a scene where he's like, you know, writing up on the. There's all the sort of chalk marks on the wall, like that. What do you call the five? I'm already murdering this joke. But he's like, there's like 25 like chalk marks up on the wall.
Yeah.
Or like there's, you know, and he says like, oh, thank you. And then his lawyer comes in. I've already completely murdered this joke, Brett. Do you know what I mean? Trying to explain...
And it's a visual joke, right?
It's a visual joke.
Right.
Listen, like, just imagine that I didn't try and explain it. Basically, the punchline is...
Yeah.
The lawyer comes in and he says, thank God you're here. I've been here 20 minutes already. Now, listen, it is so much funnier in the movie. And I don't want you to think the movie's not worth watching because I completely...
That is funny.
As much as I screwed up the like my shark joke earlier, I also
that
screwed
is
this
funny.
One. Anyway, Top Secret is my answer.
Right. Do, 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 do. Welcome.
Ah.
To the Patreon section. Look out. Look where you are. You're in the fancy bit.
It's worth stressing at this point when we get into the, you know, the Patreon.
Yes.
You know, is that it's also gone completely dark in Reader's Park. This it's like sort of quite magical, this part, for, you know, subscribers.
This is the magical dusk, magic hour.
Whenever I hear the word Patreon, it always makes me think of, like, tequila or something.
Yeah, some of them do. Patron?
Patron. That's why my mind always goes to Patron.
Well, so that's the first thing you're acknowledging to the patrons is you have a drink problem. is there something you'd like to say to the patron?
But to be honest, when anybody says anything, I think of Patron.
Edgar Wright, now, you told me you'd really thought about this one. What's the film that changed your perspective on something?
Well, I guess during lockdown, I've actually been watching, with everything that's happening in the world right now, mm-hmm. especially with the rise of fascism again.
Yeah.
I guess there's a sort of part of me where I started watching films that were like kind of World War II films mm-hmm. or documentaries, like sort of out of genuine interest, but also in that way that when people say, this is happening again, you know, don't like sort of like, let's learn from the lessons of the past, which people seem
to resist.
Incapable of doing.
Yeah.
That I guess I started watching a lot of World War II films of like, in terms of trying to understand, you know, when you think about World War II, you think about the Holocaust and from, you know, kind of like 80 years on, you know, you have to try and understand how did we get here. So I did watch a lot of World War II movies over like the lockdown. There's particularly like some really great ones that I'd already seen when I was young and I watched them again, like the Roberto Rossellini War Trilogy, Rome Open City, Paysan, and Germany Year Zero.
Okay.
The last one of which I'd never seen, but those are all like watching them as an adult were like really striking in terms of just seeing. I guess it's just that seeing like these cities like still, like what is like Rome like in 1945? What is Berlin like in 1945? It's like real like sort of just incredible time capsules of like not just the time, but also how does a city come back from that? It's sort of incredible to watch. And I also watched again like one of those movies that like is I watched Shoah, which is obviously
like 10-hour documentary
about the Holocaust, and that was a sort of shattering thing because I think like when you actually watch those things, it's to see people talking about it in such a matter-of-fact way.
It's all talking heads, is that right, Shoah?
Yeah, and there's no archive in it at all. It's all people talking
now. Survivors talking, yeah.
Survivors, not just survivors, but also Nazi guards.
Oh, wow.
Like, so they interview Nazis in it as well. And also they interview people who were bystanders, people who were in the towns who weren't in the camps, who were, like, you know, in the kind of the Polish villages, the village and stuff.
Mm.
So that was, like, I mean, a real eye-opener in terms of where you want to try and understand something from the perspective of the people who were there.
Mm.
That's the non-fun answer. But it's like, I actually talked to David Baddiel afterwards because I watched David Baddiel's documentary about Holocaust denial.
Right.
Which was incredible. And I told him I watched Shoah, and David Baddiel says, I've never actually watched the whole 10 hours. You actually did it.
Yeah.
He admitted that he sort of, you know, he said that, like, I think people say they've done that, you know, but.
Yeah, he's like, I get the gist.
So there was I did it quite a lot of that over lockdown. And there were some other, like, there's two great French movies by Jean-Pierre Melville,
mm-hmm.
who was in the French Resistance himself. And there's his first film called Le Silence de la Mer, which is about a Nazi officer who stays with a French family during the occupation, and they basically do not talk to him for the entirety of his stay.
So he's
talking to himself for the entire movie, and it's actually really like great like World War II film that has no battle scenes in it at all. It's just about their like rebellion of complete silence, and then the other one, if you've ever seen, is Army of Shadows, which is the great French Resistance film. It's amazing and so, like, brutal. Anyway, that's the non-fair answer.
Okay.
I mean, it's not more fantasy, but it's easy to say like about a film that changed your perspective on it in terms of you couldn't think the same way about the subject.
Yeah.
Is I'd say like Boogie Nights by Paul Thomas Anderson, which is A, one of my favourite films, and B,
love it.
You could never think about porn in the same way again after seeing that movie, because that so brilliantly showed you the unglamorous and disturbing behind the scenes that, like, you could never think of it in the same regard. I mean, obviously, since then, there's been, like, a ton of, like, documentaries that have, like, you know, exposed the sort of the you know, everything from Louis Theroux to, like, that documentary Hot Girls Wanted, all that.
Yeah.
Horribly disturbing documentary on Channel 4 called, I think it's called Felicia's Journey. It was like, oh, my God. Anyway, but before that, I remember seeing Boogie Nights, and it was that thing where something that you maybe... like, you want to believe that people are having fun, and you realise that 90% of the time they are not. And, like, I just thought that film was just... I just think that's one of those things where, like, nobody else could have made that. You would have...
No.
Paul Thomas Anderson lived in that area. He'd grown up around it. It was, like, an obsession for him since he was, like, 11. And he'd just been in those places. So I feel like... I mean, I love Paul's work so much, but it's still my favourite film of his, just because it feels so lived in, and it feels that... just amazing thing of having something to say on a subject that everybody's curious about. And, like, you can never think of, like, it, like pornography in the same way after having seen that film.
I love Boogie Nights. It's a film, but I always think it's a film about family.
Yes.
Like, all these films are about family, I think. And that one is entirely...
But it's
their family.
But in a sad way, and there's a thing of, like, they've only got each other.
Yes.
Only they would understand what,
yeah,
like, they're going through. I realise... Oh, I know where we are now.
Okay.
I realise in the dark we're slightly going around in circles, but we're going this way, okay. I promise. The Beefy Tower, that's where we're heading.
Edgar and I now live in Regent's Park because...
we really are in the afterlife.
What is the greatest opening sequence?
Okay.
And I tell you what, Baby Driver would be on a list somewhere.
That's very nice, thank you. I mean, I definitely thought of it in that regard of, like... I would say there's two films I could think of straight off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all of the ones that people mention, I'm not going to mention. So I'm going to go for, hopefully, two films that nobody's ever mentioned.
Go on.
Number one, 1977, Suspiria, Dario Argento's film.
Right, yes.
That film starts like most films end. And the poster for... I have a US poster for Suspiria.
Right.
In my place in LA. And the tagline for Suspiria is, the only thing scarier... than the only thing scarier than the last 10 minutes of this film are the first 80.
That's great.
Now, the thing is about that, actually, it's not quite that. It's actually something like sort of, the only thing scarier than the last 10 minutes of this film are the first, like, 92. That's what it is.
Right.
So, two things about that tagline. One is you're admitting
the
end is not as good as the rest of it, and... that would be correct, and I love that film, it's amazing. But the opening of that movie, nothing really tops it. Maybe the bit where the lady lands in the razor wire, that's an amazing sequence.
Yeah.
But the opening of Suspiria, it like starts like most movies end, and it's extraordinary the first 10 minutes of that movie. The other thing about the tagline of Suspiria is that the running time is wrong on the tagline, because the running time of the movie is like 92 minutes, and they say it's like... 102. So, like, there's 10 minutes, like, not accounted for. It's very strange. But anyway, the opening of that movie is extraordinary. And it's something like... it's an interesting thing to do is, like, to sort of, like, hit a high of, like, hysteria and terror and shock that you can't quite, like, get to that point again in the movie. They almost do. I mean, I love that movie. My other answer...
yeah.
John Woo's Hard Boiled.
Ooh.
Which opens with an action scene that, again, is, like, better than the climax of, like, 95% of the other action movies. Now, in the Hard Boiled case, they do top it. Like, it just goes further and further. But the opening, like, 10 minutes of that movie is extraordinary. And once I was programming, around the time of Hot Fuzz, I was programming in Los Angeles, and I programmed this triple bill.
Yeah.
I think it was a Hot Fuzz, Point Break, and Hard Boiled.
Wow.
And we did a Q&A for Hot Fuzz. I introduced Point Break, and then I was sticking around to introduce Hard Boiled. And I remember, and by this time, Simon and Nick had long gone. It was just me introducing Hard Boiled. And there was about maybe a third of the crowd left for Hard Boiled, the third movie. This is maybe like starting at midnight.
Okay.
And I did this intro. I probably had a couple of G&Ts by this point. I did this intro to Hard Boiled where I was really bigging it up, saying, like, hands up who's never seen this movie before. Like, 80% of the hands go up saying, oh, my God, you're in for such a ride. This is the greatest action movie of all time. Like, you're not going to regret having stuck around for this one. It is extraordinary. And, like, sort of... So I really, really, really bigged it up. And then I went to leave, because I was just introducing. And as I was leaving, a couple, like, walked out. And I stopped them and I said, wait. I said, you waited for my intro and you're not going to watch the movie? And they said, oh, we really wanted, but we're tired, saying, just watch the first 10 minutes. I'll come back in with you. So I frog-marched this couple back into the cinema and I sat with them.
Holding them down.
Such a kind of film Nazi. I sat with them to make sure they watched it. But I basically like walked them back in and sat down and watched the opening scenes from them just to say, come on, isn't that the greatest opening ever? Which it really is. And I run into that person since and they did stay and watch the whole thing.
That's great.
But that sort of gives you the idea of how sort of like, you know, kind of annoying I am to watch films with.
Well, that's what I wanted to check. I mean, that's good. I absolutely respect that. What's the greatest ending to a film?
The good, the bad, and the ugly. Like, because that, I just actually, that was, I went to see that in lockdown at the cinema. Because the NFT reopened and they were showing a Morricone season.
Yeah.
And I took three people who'd never seen the movie. And we all, actually, that cinema, they took out every other seat. So we all, like, sitting separately from each other. But it's that movie where, like, it's already great. And then the last 15 minutes just, like, sort of, like, pushes it over the edge into sort of, like, you know, eternal status. It's like the final duel with, like two Ennio Morricone cues in a row, the Ecstasy of Gold, and then the cue called the Trio. Like, you're already in, like, just like, it's just like Nirvana. It's just so extraordinary. And also, it's so simple. It's just three people standing in a triangle, in a circle, but it's like the greatest scene ever.
Yeah, two people just staring at each other really hard.
Three people.
Three people doing hard stares.
Yeah. And look, also, music. And it relates to Baby Driver because Ennio Morricone wrote the music before they started shooting the movie, so Sergioni could play that music in on set. So when Lee Van Cleef and Eli Wallach and Clint Eastwood are standing there, they are hearing that music. Because if they weren't hearing that music, they probably would have said, are we standing here too long?
Yeah.
Are you sure this is going to work? Like, but if that music's playing, you feel like, oh, I could stand here for 90 seconds and just stand here. And it's the most thrilling thing ever. People standing still, their hands very slowly moving towards their holsters.
I like that. I like that a lot. What's your favourite film?
My favourite film, Raising Arizona.
Great.
It's one of those movies that, like, that along with Evil Dead 2, the movies I saw when I was, like, maybe, like, 15, that really, like, just jump-started. I was already interested in being a director. Or, like, but those are the movies that really made me, like, pick up the cameras, like, I have to do this. And, like, Raising Arizona was, like, such a confounding movie as, like, a comedy fan because it's so well shot and put together. And I feel that that movie, more than anything, just, like, inspired, like, you know, kind of just trying to aspire to that level of execution. It's, like... I think it's something that I'm not even sure the Coen brothers know how good it is.
They never like it, but it's
such an extraordinary movie and so well put together and so like dense in terms of like dialogue, camera shots, the way it's edited, just like it's just incredible that movie. And sort of all in the service of like it's that thing of like elevating material that in anybody else's hands would end up being like a really like silly throwaway movie, but they somehow take like these kind of like, you know, trailer park rednecks and make it into something like the Good, the Bad, the Ugly. It's amazing.
Edgar Wright, you've been phenomenal as expected. I appreciate all your time and for taking me around Regent's Park. However, when you had been bad mouthing Jaws the Revenge and the sharks, right, but you forgot you'd done that, but they were listening. Sharks never forget, famously. And you decided to face your fears and go and swim deep sea in Italy.
the famous shark infested waters of Italy.
You went to Italy, had a swim, thinking nothing could happen here, it's Italy. And then two of the sharks from Jaws of Revenge, who had been watching you and waiting, and they followed you all the way to Italy, and one of them took the front end, one of them took the back end, pulled you in half like a Christmas cracker.
Oh, and were there jokes inside?
Yeah. One joke about lines on a prison wall, and one...
about being eaten by a shark. Well, very meta. It was like a Russian doll.
Yeah.
My death was a...
was your own cracker jokes. Anyway.
No, the joke inside was what's yellow and deadly... shark infested custard, right? That's the joke.
That was the joke.
That's the Christmas cracker joke.
Yeah. So, I've been looking for you. I went to Italy because let's call it stalking, whatever. And I've gone to Italy to see you. And you're not there. You're nowhere to be found. I'm like, oh, maybe I'll give up. Just enjoy the weather. So I'm on the beach, and washed up to the beach is your bloated, sea-swollen carcass. In various bits, mashed up in the sand, all sorts of
like the other bits from the Jaws board game, like
the other bits from the Jaws board game.
Fish bones, and like a license bones, plate,
license
and a
plate,
wheel maybe.
Yeah, a wheel, a ship's wheel.
Yes,
and a mouth organ.
Yes,
and anyway, I'm like, fuck it, oh Edgar, oh mate. Anyway, I've been carrying a coffin with me as I often do, and it was the right size for you, but I didn't expect you to have swollen in the sea. So I was just like, this ain't going to fit, so I have to get... I end up actually getting one of your own bones and just smashing it into you, trying to carve you up into smaller bits. Anyway, I managed to get you down to smaller bits, press it all into this coffin, but
I could probably go for a child's coffin, save some money.
There's so little left. I wish you'd said that. I wish you said that before I invested in this one. It's very heavy. Anyway, I've got you all in there, stuffed you all in. There's no room in this coffin now. There's only enough room that I could slide one DVD into the side. And you can take that DVD to the other side. And on the other side, it's movie night every night. And one night, it's your movie night. What movie are you showing everyone when it's your movie night in heaven? Go.
I'm going to cheat slightly, but it's just a one light package. There's a Warner Brothers box set of Busby Berkeley movies. And it's like four movies. So it's not that big. You could probably fit it in the coffin, especially if if I'd been bitten in two, you could literally have my top half, my bottom half, and this box set would fit squarely in the middle.
I'm not happy about this.
Okay, well, I'll pick one.
You're going to have to take one of the DVDs from the collection.
I'll do that. Okay, I can do that. Okay. I'll say the box set features 42nd Street, Footlight Parade, Gold Diggers of 1933, and Dames. So if I'm only allowed one, I'm going to go for Dames.
And he's taking Dames to the other side.
Yes. It also feels a little bit almost like being buried with a Busby Berkeley DVD. Feels like sort of some kind of like very late period coming out. You know, like sort of like, you know, just like if you're buried with a Liberace album or something. It's like, oh, I didn't know. But anyway, I love Busby Berkeley. They're like movies that like just like those movies, his sequences in those movies could not be made today. Like, you would never be able to, like, have those big sets, that many dancers, that level of, like, sort of execution. I'm always confounded when you watch old movies and you think, nobody would let you do that today. And the Busby Berkeley always, like, blows my mind. And my favourite sequence from Dames is the I Only Have Eyes For You sequence, which is just extraordinary. If you've never seen it, just like treat yourself. It's just so extraordinary. It, like, that sequence features like Ruby Keeler and like 50 other dancers dressed as Ruby Keeler, and every shot in that sequence is something that you've seen ripped off in another movie or another commercial. And so when you actually get to the kind of like the headstream of like thinking, oh, this is where this comes from. Like, he's just one of those people who was just so light years ahead of his time that you're always stunned when you actually watch The Source, and it's like, wow, this movie from 1934 could not be equal today. So that would be my pick.
Edgar Wright, is there anything you'd like to tell people to look out for?
In the graveyard somewhere, are copies of Footlight Parade, Gold Diggers of 1933, and 42nd Street that I wasn't allowed to put in.
Yeah.
So if you get down there fast enough, they might still be there by the gravestone, and you can have them.
And of your own stuff? So what's the next two things coming up for people to look out for?
Last Night in Soho.
Yeah.
Coming to cinemas.
I called it One Night in Soho at the beginning of this podcast, okay, and it's been haunting me ever since.
Last Night in Soho.
But you're sticking with Last Night.
And also a documentary about Sparks, which is coming next year as well, called The Sparks Brothers.
Nice.
Enjoy.
Edgar Wright, thank you for doing this. Have a lovely time on the other side. Happy Death Day.
Thank you.
So what?
So that was episode 127. Head over to the Patreon section for his shocking, it's disgusting secret and all kinds of treats for all the other episodes at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein. Go to Apple Podcasts, give us a 5-star rating and tell us about the film that means the most to you so that Maureen can have a lovely Christmas. And all of you, I want to say, have a wonderful Christmas. I hope you all have a lovely time together or apart on Zooms, however you're doing it. Thank you also to Edgar for doing such a long walk with me. Thanks to Scroobius Pip and the Distraction Pieces Network. Thanks to Buddy Peace for producing it. Thanks to Acast for hosting it. Thanks to Adam Richardson for the graphics and Lisa Lydon for the photography. Come and join me next week. It'll be New Year's Eve, I think. I'll put out something good. Don't you worry about it. So that is it for now. All of you, have a wonderful Christmas. And please, as always, be excellent to each other.
Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas, everyone. God bless us, one and all.
Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.